You're listening to The Record on KUOW, and I'm David Hyde with Steve Scheer. And so, Steve.
Yes?
The recent government shutdown in the other Washington has a lot of people wondering how the United States can be so divided.
You know what? I talked to the comedian Colin Quinn recently for a conversation we're going to have. He's a very political comedian. His show is called Unconstitutional. He thinks we should have a trial separation between the red states and the blue states. He thinks it's ingrained.
All right. So author Simon Winchester says if you go back far enough in history, it took a really long time for Americans to unite and see themselves as part of one nation indivisible. His latest book is called The Men Who United the States. And I got a chance to speak with Simon Winchester about it when he was in town. Simon Winchester, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you.
So I want to get the sense of this history. You say sort of way back when, after the American Revolution even, America wasn't really very united. How did Americans see themselves at that time?
Well, initially, the rivalry between the original 13 states and the 13 colonies that were was profound. I mean, you've only got to watch John Adams, the television program, to realize that, you know, North Carolina felt very differently about the country that was in the making from, let's say, the people in Massachusetts and New York. But, you know, gradually things sort of settled themselves down into some sort of uneasy compact. And really the unification as a sort of a central core of the new nation's philosophy only became dominant, I think, after, well, certainly when the lands west of the Ohio River were being settled, and we're talking about the 1790s, the early 1800s, and then, of course, once the Louisiana Purchase had occurred in 1803. And that, I think, was the turning point. Once it was evident to Jefferson in particular that the country extended all the way to the Pacific Ocean, and that therefore there could be a pan-continental unity about this new nation, then the rivalries were swiftly forgotten and the country got on with the business of becoming one nation indivisible.
Simon Winchester is a journalist, writer, and broadcaster. His latest book is The Men Who United the States, about the changes that made Americans more united as a nation. And one of the stories that you tell in this book, which is just fascinating for people who don't know it well, is the story of the Erie Canal. What was the problem that this canal was attempting to solve?
Well, it's funny. We, as an English schoolboy, because as you can probably tell, I'm English, although I'm now an American, have been for the last couple of years, I remember my schoolmaster, geography master, was called Harold Mann. And when we were 11 and 12, one of the perennial exam questions he set us was discuss the importance, boys, of the Hudson-Mohawk Gap. And we all knew exactly where it was and why it was important in American history. I would venture to say that almost no American 11-year-old schoolchild today would have the foggiest idea of what the Hudson-Mohawk Gap was. A physical valley, the Mohawk River Valley, that extends essentially from the Great Lakes to the Hudson and provides a passageway for goods to come from the middle of America to the Atlantic Ocean via this, at that time, the 1820s, very small port of New York. And the farms that were upstream of places that, you know, you won't know terribly well out here in the West, but in Canandaigua and Syracuse and places like that, couldn't get their goods to market because the Mohawk River is full of rapids and waterfalls and things. And there were one or two small canals that had been built, but they charged exorbitant rates. And it all went down to a man called Jesse Hawley, who was a baker who lived in Canandaigua. He, to get his flour to the markets in New York City, he had to pay these extortionate rates. It drove him bankrupt. He went to debtor's prison, which was the way these things were dealt with in the early 19th century, and while there decided to research the whole question of canals in Europe, which were transforming the economic landscape. And he came up with a very detailed idea of how long a canal should be along the Hudson-Mohawk Gap, and how many locks there should be, how many feet it would need to ascend, which is about 540. And he wrote these columns in the Genesee Messenger, which was the local newspaper, under the pen name Hercules, from his prison cell. There were 14 of them, arguing in great detail exactly how this canal should be built. And they were read by the then governor of New York State, DeWitt Clinton, who said, you know, this is a very good idea. And he persuaded the New York State Assembly to put aside $7 million. And once Hawley was out of prison, dug the first sod, and eventually the canal was created. And one of the first guests at this wonderful ceremony called the Wedding of the Waters, where buckets of Lake Erie water was ceremonially tipped into the Atlantic Ocean with lots of press, obviously no movie cameras back in those days. One of the first guests to witness this was the man who, from his jail cell, had originated this farmer, Jesse Hawley.
How big of an undertaking was this? You say it was $7 million, but at the time, just as an engineering feat, what did it take to build this Erie Canal?
Well, it took all sorts of, amazing sort of leviathans, because this is really before the days of steam-powered shovels and the kind of things that, for instance, could build the Panama Canal and the Suez Canal. And one of the things was a gigantic set of iron wheels connected by an axle. And if you put a rope down there and attach those to a recalcitrant stump of a tree that you had cut down and which was in your way, if you rolled these mighty many, many ton wheels, it would lift this stump out of the earth in a way that no human at the time could possibly do. So it was the beginning of very big but very primitive machines, but it also employed a very large number of Irishmen. Irishmen came over here in very large numbers to work on the Erie Canal. And, of course, Pete Seeger wrote the song and, you know, the labouring, the union aspect of this whole story. I mean, many things were brought to life, not only big machines, but also the unionisation of labour became a reality with the enormous amount of manpower needed to build this important canal.
Simon Winchester is a writer, and his latest book is The Men Who United the States. And I'm just wondering, so what's the connection between this engineering project? You mentioned unionization, but what was the significance for New Yorkers and for the country, you know, this broader theme that you're writing about of greater unity in the United States?
Well, I mean, this specific case, this led to the growth of New York City into the mercantile engine that it is today. But the overall theme of the book is not simply canals. Obviously, that's just one small part of it. It is the physical links. It's the connective tissue that binds this country together. Because my thesis, if I don't want to sound too academic about this, is that this word, the United States, I mean, it is remarkable that this gigantic entity has, aside from the unpleasantness in the 1860s, the Civil War, it has remained pretty steadfastly united, despite what's going on in Congress these days, in a way that other gigantic entities like Canada, Russia, Europe, they've not managed to achieve it. I mean, look at Canada. I mean, it's a wonderful country, but it does have this great francophone chunk of sort of grumpy people in the middle, in Quebec, who are forever arguing for separatism. Russia, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, has dissolved into dozens of little competing, there's a great problem at the moment with Ukraine and chocolate imports. I mean, ludicrous stuff. Russia's clearly not united. And Europe, where I come from, I mean, England, we don't use the euro. We're breaking up with Scotland at the moment. Switzerland's not a member. If you plug in your electric razor in Stockholm, you're going to need a different plug than in Madrid. But in America, thanks to the efforts of people like Jesse Hawley and the building of the Erie Canal, but in all other sorts of way, it's entirely possible for people, an Algonquian Indian in Maine or a Sephardic Jew in New York or a Latina stallholder in Albuquerque, all to feel that they're part of one thing. And I would argue that it is the physical connective tissues that have been built that helps Americans all to feel one.
I guess a point of disunion right now has to do with people's perspective on the role of the federal government. One of the stories you write about in here is a story probably more familiar with people here in the West, the story of the railroads. What was the historic role of the federal government in that case and kind of more generally?
Well, the federal government was enormously involved. I mean, and Lincoln was the lawyer for the Union Pacific Railway, which was essentially a government-backed, slightly more complicated than that, railroad moving westwards from Omaha, whereas a privately financed railroad, the Central Pacific, moving from Sacramento eastwards, and the two of them joined, as you well know, in 1869 at Promontory Summit, and the Transcontinental Railway was a reality. I mean, one overarching theme in this book is that good ideas that were the children of inventors like Samuel Morse, or in the case of the railway, Theodore Judah, this somewhat mad son of a Connecticut preacher who discovered the proper route for the railroad through the Sierra Mountains. These ideas were, in most cases, or many cases, taken up by and had to be taken up by, because they had such gigantic implications, by the federal government. The federal government played an enormous role in the uniting of this country. And that's something that is that is overlooked today in the sort of in the partisan hysteria that goes on in Washington. I mean, a classic case, if I can just cite one, is the bringing of electricity to America's farms. The capitalist owners of the big electric utility companies in the 1930s thought that the farmers, it was uneconomical to give them electricity. So when FDR came to power in the 1930s, one of the many agencies he set up as part of the New Deal was the REA, the Rural Electrification Administration, which brought electricity to the farms. And the irony that I think is very sweet today is that the farmland that first got electricity in 1935 is in western Ohio, near the town of Miami, Ohio, the 8th Congressional District. And the 8th Congressional District of Ohio is represented today by John Boehner. So the most archetypal anti-big government politician in all of Washington presides over an area of farmland that benefited gigantically from the biggest big government America's ever known.
So where do you think this is all headed as a part of our national conversation, if we can take you to the present? I mean, on this question of sort of unity and people's perspective on the role of government and these big projects that have historically united us.
Well, I'm afraid we're going through a period where, you know, states' rights, individual rights, the market, and all these buzzwords are seeming momentarily or temporarily more fashionable than big government. The word, the phrase big government is an unutterable sort of something one just doesn't talk about these days. And yet it's necessary. I mean, in my view, to modernize this country, to bring its infrastructure up to date, to bring high-speed rail, for instance, to California. I mean, it is atrocious, I think, that to get from Seattle to Los Angeles, it's by train, it's hugely inconvenient. Whereas, I mean, I lived for many years in China. To get from Beijing to Hong Kong, similar distance, I can do it in 7 hours. I mean, luxury trains rocketing through the country. But to do that, it can't be left solely to the marketplace or the Koch brothers or people like that. You've got to have government assistance. And that requires taxes to be levied on people. I happen not to think that taxes are a bad thing if the result in the end is a society which is modern and brilliantly connected one side to the other. And it's falling apart at the moment because there seems to be no national will behind the kind of efforts that FDR did so brilliantly. You look at the Hoover Dam or the great structures that were put up, the national park system, all the, you know, the results of government at work, and you think, my God, I'm so glad the government did this. But this period in our history, and I say ours because I'm an American now, I pay taxes, and I wouldn't resent paying taxes if the result of it was the further unification of this country.
Simon Winchester's new book is The Men Who United the States. And you are English. You became a citizen in 2011. And I kind of want to end just there, which is where you begin the book, but by asking you how that decision to become a U.S. citizen and that experience of becoming a U.S. citizen shaped your approach in the book.
Very much so. I mean, I first fell in love with this country in the 1960s when I came here as a 17-year-old hitchhiker. People were immensely kind to me. I realized that these were a very special people that lived in this extraordinary country, which was blessed with spectacular scenery, marvelous weather, incredible natural resources, and a great feeling of sort of can-do and opportunity. And I came back here as a correspondent for a newspaper in the 70s and then and again in the 80s. And when finally I left China in the mid-90s, I had this sort of fork in the road moment, deciding whether to my future, the rest of my life, would be in London or New York. I came to New York. I started paying taxes. And then the old mantra of no taxation without representation reared its head. And I thought, well, if I'm paying taxes, I'm jolly well began, you know, to vote the rascals out or in, as the case may be. So I started the process. And eventually, as you mentioned, on Independence Day 2011, on the after deck of the USS Constitution, this wonderful old warship in Boston Harbor, I got my citizenship. And I'm a very proud American, and I cherish this country. I think for all the ills and the failings of this nation, it is a remarkable, remarkable shining city on a hill, and I want to do my little bit to cheer people up and remind them what a great place this is.
Simon Winchester, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's writer Simon Winchester. His latest book is called The Men Who United the States. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. I'm David Hyde with Steve Scheer.